Good evening. I paint you Romeo India Whiskey. Each process is turned on. And this is the beginning of our hitman. Hitman number 1512 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. 31 years ago. Going on 31 years ago. This is a gathering of people who are curious. Just like the people at Large Hadron Collider. Those are the people who have spent 20, 30, 40, 50 years trying to figure out what Mother Nature is saying. What is a proton, electron, a molecule, an atom? What do those things really look like? No one has ever seen one. We amateurs have never seen a radio wave. We think we know how it works. We think we know what it would look like if we could see it. But no one has ever seen one. As such, it's quite a mystery. We've got curiosity. If you want to know more, you're in the right place. You'll hear that there's a gathering of people here that try to help each other stumble through the learning curve on how does radio and wireless equipment really work. There is nobody who knows it all about radio. There is nobody who knows it all about molecules, subatomic particles. In all cases, no one has ever seen one. Most likely no one will ever see one. But we know how it acts. We've got a whole bunch of experimental evidence of how it acts. One of these guys has got in the back of his head, each one of these guys who have been involved in radio for a good portion of their lifetime, who have fallen in love with action at a distance. That's what radio really is. You press down the key, York State, and I'm dying in New Zealand. Here's the fact that you've done that. Sending some Morse code, he recognizes your fist and you're in communication, or you're sending him sideband, you're sending him a satellite signal. Boy, is that action at a distance. A zillion miles away, and the signal gets there in microseconds. Fantastic process. How in the world does it do that? Someday somebody's going to understand a little bit more about it. And the hams are, for the most part, the ones that are doing an awful lot of the research. From my point of view, a cell phone, there's something like 6.5 billion cell phones in the world in use right now. From my point of view, that is a ham radio invention. A big portion of that invention took place by Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, in New Jersey. He's a guy I used to talk to every other night, every third night on 432, when I first got on that band way back in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And that's when he was doing that work. One of the major guys, nobody knows that. Talk to anybody who's using a cell phone. Ask them who invented it. You'll get an answer. You'll get an answer as to the guy who made the first cell phone call in New York City, who called up one of his buddies at AT&T, where the real research had taken place. Let me drop it. By way of phone patches and a touch-tone pad on a handy target, we amateurs were doing the equivalent of cell phoning way back in the late 60s, early 70s. Along came a man who invented the cell site distribution system by which real fancy communication from almost everywhere on planet Earth can take place. So that's a chunk of wireless electronics that has sort of caught on. Yep, TechNet follows a particular menu which continuously changes. John, KC2WGB, usually monitors nowadays for the last month or two. He monitors the Echo Link so that people who are trying to sign in and can't make it, it's now a lot easier. John will know that you're trying to sign in. You can send him messages. And so even if some of us get super excited, we jump the gun and don't wait long enough between transmissions so that the system can reset properly. When that happens, now John knows about it. So you're not going to be left out in the cold anymore. It says here. And if I let us know about it, we'll try to make further modifications. So the menu we're about to follow. But you guys who really do have a question or a comment, they're going to sign in. Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in to say you're listening. In theory, we've got people from quite a few states, and in some cases, a couple of different countries who are doing the listening. And for 31 years, we believe somebody's listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. And I'm not going to give out that mysterious call that everybody who runs the net thinks that they've got to give out. Is there any emergency traffic? It never is. But if somebody has started that tradition, what in the world is the meaning of that? Is there any emergency traffic? Alrighty, so I'm not even going to ask that question. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and We're going to take those names down as a list. Joe Demetriou signed in last week, and we didn't get a chance to get to him. He gets up super early in the morning, so when he signs in tonight, no matter when he signs in, he goes to the head of the line, because 2 weeks in a row he was not properly addressed, if you know what I mean. My job. Also, I'd like you guys to give me a hint. I'm going to ask for that a little bit later, as to what was field day like for you. The high holy day is a field day. Was Saturday and Sunday, ending today at 2 p.m. And lots and lots of people gathered. I could tell that quite a few of them had some substantial installations that seemed to work out very well. I'd like to hear some of the words from the people who led those operations, were involved in those operations. So a little bit later on, I'm going to be asking you guys to give us a description of what was field day like for you. What part of it did you like? What part of it did you not like? Because that could be corrected. So our menu is going to be, as I said, taking call letters and names. After that, John, KC2WGB, will read the mailbag for the people who not equipped yet to talk to us live directly, particularly students, for instance. We'll send him emails with some very challenging questions. And that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who tells us once again, that question I always ask, how far away is Voyager? And it's moving away from us at something like 40,000 miles an hour. The darn thing is something like 190 astronomical units away, something like 8 billion miles away, with a QRP transmitter, something like 20 watts total power into the transmitter, talking to us from 8 billion miles. At the speed of light, the signal takes 15 and a half hours to get here. And is that DX? Wow. In miles per watt, nobody comes close to anywhere near doing that. That is serious radio. How in the world does that signal at 8 gigahertz go that far and not get tired? Which is a very strong piece of evidence of what I've said now for years. Let me drop it. Once you create a radio signal, no matter how weak, no matter how strong, no matter how good the antenna, no matter how bad the antenna, once you radiate a radio signal, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. And stop it from doing that. It goes everywhere. I didn't say it's going to be easy to reach everywhere, but it goes everywhere. It never stops. It occurs by the inverse square law in a predictable manner. But no matter where you are in this universe, the only thing left to discuss is that signal above threshold of the equipment you're using now. And if you're like NASA, when you make continuous improvement in your deep space network, how weak a signal you can receive is going to continuously get better and better. Goes everywhere, including inside of that 100 dB tempest proof screen room that you just constructed. The signal goes there too. It's 100 dB weaker, but it's still there. It never goes to zero. Ain't that crazy? Okay, so along the way, if somebody asks a question where it's appropriate, how T6 dBZ gives the more brief answer. You've got a lot of radio experience, as opposed to my long-winded answer. In some cases, we give both answers. The price is right, if you know what I mean. So, if you've got a real question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, give me a call at us. Start right now. KQLIW listening. It was very Eric, yes. Eric recognized. I've heard of him. Sorry, I didn't get to you yesterday. And we'll get an explanation for that a little bit later. Eric first. Anyone else, give me a call at us a name right now if you've got a real question or a comment for the TechNet.
Joanne, with the Space Report. Good evening, Dick. John now.
Very fine, Paul. WS2N. Anyone else checking? I think we've tired everybody out. The guys who are really serious with the field day will sometimes start setting up fairly early in the morning on Saturday, go around the clock, telling each other war stories. And by now, they're trying to catch up on the last 24 hours of non-sleeping. Anyone else to give me a call letter and name right now because they've got a question or a comment? Go right ahead. KQLAW. I think we put everyone to sleep. Eric, you're number one on the runway. You may be the only flight taking off today. So take your time. Give us every one of the details of whatever you're about to tell us or ask us. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
KQRIW, KE2J. Now, I know you're subscribed to RF GlobalNet, or Global RFNet,
and I don't remember whether it was Thursday or Friday's edition, they had an article about the biological effects of terahertz waves, and I'm curious if you read it, and if you did read it, what kind of an opinion do you have about it? K2RWK2J. Oh, no, I haven't read it yet, Eric. And, although I am far from being an expert, during the 35 years that I worked for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where I personally worked on some of the highest power transmitters the Air Force has ever created on an airplane, the B-1B bomber. I was working on that for more than 20 years. The highest power transmitter ever put on a Navy airplane is the EA-6D standoff jammer. I worked on those jamming pods. I worked on quite a few other high power transmitters. So from time to time, I was used as a local quasi-expert as to whether or not this particular planned operation was or was not going to be violating the minimum or maximum permitted exposure of radio frequency biohazard for the staff. So I've got lots of opinions about the radio and the safety. So no, I have not read this one. Give us a thumbnail sketch or give us a full description of what they appear to be saying, Eric. And one of the things that's really troubling me all of these years, and that is, if we had a chance to do it all over again, Hiram, Percy, Maxim, anyone else who is doing early work on radio, let me drop it. And when they sent a signal into an antenna and discovered that it goes out in all directions, radiates, perfectly good word. But I wish they didn't go then the next step to say that the process is radiation, the past tense of radiating. I wish they had called it radio transmission, radio signaling, anything else. Because they didn't know it, but 40 years later, World War II is going to come along. Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombing and nuclear power stations, and all of a sudden we have nuclear radiation. The general public, nuclear radiation and RF radiation are the same thing. It's worse than apple and orange. It's comparing an apple to a pencil, if you know what I mean. There's almost no relationship between the two. So a hell of a lot of the fear that people have for radio is a fear of a vocabulary word, radiation. And in many cases, 90-some-odd percent of the cases, fear is unfounded and misunderstood. So tell me what they said, Paul, K2EJ, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW. K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm going to point out a couple of things, but I'm going to defer this conversation until you read, it's actually two articles, and I know you subscribe to it, so you'll find it there. They specifically isolate lower frequencies, even gigahertz frequencies, from terahertz frequencies. And they also say that there's never been a study done. And this group, the university, and it's a couple of universities, actually. One in this country, and I think another one in Korea, and Japan. I'm going to defer this conversation until you read it. I mean, short of reading a damn article on the air, which wouldn't be fair, I think it's something you need to read, and then I'm sure you will formulate an opinion from it. It's written in such a way that you will agree with most of it, okay? And the methodology that's used, I believe you will agree. But let's wait until you've actually made the effort to read that and then think about it. It goes with a lot of the things that you have been saying, continue to say, but as we are beginning to get into higher and higher frequencies, it seems like some of the characteristics are beginning to change. So, I'll leave it at that, and if you want, I'll tell you the story about the FM transmitter. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah,
from an ham radio point of view, Eric, you have arguably the world's best occupation. We amateur radio operators, who just love transmitters and receivers, transmitters in particular, and microphones and cameras that we can sit in front of. We are very, very envious of anybody who works in radio or television broadcast. That's the ultimate radio. High power, high antennas, high location, big antennas, fancy equipment, all that kind of jazz. So you've got the most ideal occupation, Eric. and so we're stuck. The defining document for the United States is the American National Institute, American National Standards Institute, C95 report, subdivision of the American Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. The C95 report, which is now, well, I guess, around for 40, 50 years, it is the defining document for the United States for radio frequency biohazard, what is safe and what is not safe. That is the document that is the bedrock used by OSHA, NIOSH, Department of Defense, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, whatever. The people who do biomedical research. That particular report, which is now probably in its 8th edition, 40th year, 50th year, it contains more than 450 references. And those references refer to experiments that were done by the best universities, the best institutions, the best testing laboratories worldwide. So for anybody to say that we've never done any testing, what planet are they on? What are they smoking? Now, we're talking about terahertz wave, which has only recently been able to generate. When you look at the so-called bathtub-shaped curve, that's in the ANSI report, which describes the MPE, maximum permitted exposure. Below 30 megacycles, the curve is rising, because below 30 megacycles, the RF energy goes through you with almost no effect. So the maximum permitted exposure goes up. 30 to 300 is the region where the majority of the RF energy hitting you gets absorbed by your skin, gets turned into heat. And whether or not it's safe is strictly a function of, can your body tolerate that amount of heating? When you consider the amount of heating that radio energy can give you compared to what the sun can give you, when you lay on the beach on a nice hot summer day and the sun is beating down on you with 1.3 thousand watts per square meter of solar energy heating up your body, your body tolerates that. What we expose ourselves to with radio-wise is almost always an extremely small fraction of that. When you get above 1,500 megacycles, the so-called microwave frequency, which sounds dangerous as all hell, all of a sudden the curve starts going up again, because 20% of the energy above 1,500 megacycles reflects off the surface of your skin, 20% gets penetrating, 80% reflects. And now, and when we get to terahertz, does the curve turn around again, is what the next question you and I are going to ask each other. When we get to terahertz, which is above 1,000 gigahertz, does that curve of rising exposure that you're allowed, the right-hand side of the bathtub case, the curve, so to speak, let me drop. Every frequency region has its particular characteristics when it comes to the way the radio signal propagates, the way the kind of equipment you use, the kind of antennas you use for transmitting and receiving, and the transmitters and receivers themselves, the transmission lines you use. Each frequency region has its desirable characteristics. And you want to really get into the terahertz, use optical. We all who are radio exposure people, radio familiar people, have a good feeling for what is 600 megahertz. You take a 600 megahertz radio signal, make it 1 million times higher in frequency, nothing else. Just make it 1 million times higher in frequency than 600 megahertz, and you and I call that red-green, we call that yellow-green optical. It's an optical signal. That's what your eye responds to. And so, yes, there are so-called eye-safe and non-eye-safe regions in the infrared region, where the amount of exposure you can put into your eye and whether or not it can possibly do damage is something that's been pretty well documented. So way up there at 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz, lots of research has taken place. Way down here, below 1,000 gigahertz, below terahertz, quite a bit of experiments have taken place. In that narrow region in between, not so narrow, but above 1,000 gigs, where now we're starting to develop the equipment, is there going to be some brand new characteristics of your eye, your finger, your body, your reproductive organs, and whatever? That remains to be seen. So I guess this article is starting to address that. So this is a region that is reasonably untapped up till now, because the equipment to generate the signal essentially wasn't there. Well, let me drop on that one. question. I can name a couple of people at AIL who have made specific work at numbers, at terahertz frequencies. I'll admit that they didn't do a whole lot of work there, but and it was I'm trying to look up the guy's name right now. Somebody I know pretty well. In my calculator. Why in the world am I not finding his name right now? Dave? Well, his... I'll find him. Anyhow, there's a guy at Airborne Instruments Laboratory that did a whole lot of work right near the terahertz region. Designing transmitters, receivers, frequency multipliers, crystal detectors, receivers, and so on. So some work has taken place. I'll admit the amount of power you could generate there until very recently was extremely small. So does the article say all of a sudden it was generating watts of power at terahertz frequencies where we used to generate microwatts and milliwatts? K2A, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
K2JS, he does. He also points out many of the things that you've already said. That's why I really want you to read it before we go any further. The reason why he goes into it is that we're now beginning to develop devices, essentially, at those frequencies. Literally, almost act like X-rays. Not the effects of X-rays, when I'm talking about that, but a property that is similar to X-rays in terms of passing through stuff and getting images. So other types of security devices that are coming on board, other types of information that's coming on board as a terahertz wave and not as microwatt power. So I recommend reading it first, and then we can have a really good discussion about it. But I found it interesting, and I think you will find it interesting. So along the same realm, there is, unfortunately I don't have the stuff in front of me, but they've come up with a new form of cloaking device. This is a different subject, which I also found interesting. I don't think it was Dallas Global, but it was another, I think it was a publication. There's a whole bunch of new stuff that's coming out that's really interesting, but unknown in terms of the terahertz wave, where they've been utilizing it in products that they're developing at this point. And it was of interest to these folks to look into it and see if there were any biological effects, but you gotta read it, because I'm not gonna try and duplicate what's in there without the thing being in front of me. So,
EIO with a related question. Hey, it sounds like EIO. We're gonna get to you in a second, Mr. EIO. Now we only heard the suffix, the prefix didn't come through. I just squeezed the mic long enough. The chief scientist of Airborne Instruments Laboratory for quite a number of years was a man named Jesse Tao. Jesse and I know each other pretty well. I've taken a number of courses with him, in-service courses that he gave at the company. I'm a life member of the Microwave Theory and Technique Society of the IEEE. Jesse Tao is on the advisory board for the MTT bowl for 20 or 30 years at least. So he's one of the people, he's probably the main person, probably the main person who has done a lot of work at roughly 0.6 and 0.8 terahertz. And I think he has, for a short period of time, gotten into terahertz. And so, but in those days when he was doing that work, roughly 20 years ago, microwatts and milliwatts is all he could generate in those days. And I think you're telling me now that the latest gallium nitride, some of the very fancy materials are starting to develop significant amounts of power up there. And what we amateur radio operators and other radio operators keep discovering over and over again, that those higher and higher so-called useless frequencies are not useless. The ham radio operators were given the frequencies above 3 megacycles because they were considered to be useless. And then frequencies above 30 megacycles, and then frequencies above 300 megacycles, and then frequencies above 3 gigahertz, and then frequencies above 30 gigahertz. That theme gets repeated every decade or so. That upper frequency region that looks like it's useless, all of a sudden the hams and other enthusiasts start building the equipment, start testing it, and all of a sudden they find out, wow, look the way this acts. The higher the frequency, the more directivity you get out of a finite-sized antenna. That antenna that's on Voyager, that's doing all that yeoman work of sending that signal 8 billion miles. It's something like an 8.5 foot, or is it a 10 foot, a diameter parabolic dish running at 8,500 megahertz. So high enough in frequency, and that particular antenna you're using suddenly gets a sharper and sharper signal with more and more gain. As long as you've got the resources to be able to properly aim it, no limit to how far you can go with it, so to speak. Okay, the person who has a further question or comment, it sounded like EIO. Give me your full call and name, sir, and then proceed with your question. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. The call here is November 2, Alpha India Romeo. My name is Greg. I live in Mashpat, Queens. And before I continue, let me make sure I'm making it, because I have been having pushed the talk switch.
Okay, November 2, Alpha India Romeo. A little bit noisy. I'm wearing earphones. I can probably pick out your signal. You had a burst of noise and you gave me the name, and I'm pretty sure you said your name is Greg. And you're in Mashpat, Queens. So we're hearing you well enough, Greg, question mark. So proceed with your question. K2RIW.
Okay, you're right, Dick. The name is Greg. The Mashpat, Queens. My question. I'm very closely related to someone who worked at K16. And you mentioned the fact that.
Greg, if you pass it back to me, Murphy's Law is not shining on you. We heard you say that something I said is related to somebody that you know, about as much as we got, and after that the signal left.
Again, the Western Brazil is trying to turn it on.
Go right ahead. Okay, so it looks like we're going to make changes to the system, Greg, so that your signal will get through earlier, better. Eric is making that change. Eric, tell us when we're ready, and we'll have Greg repeat this question. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Ready.
Okay, we've turned on the Western input. Greg, so please repeat your question. N2, Alpha India Romeo, KE2LAW.
Okay, thank you very much, Eric. All right, my question is, I am related, well, my son, until very recently was in a prowler squadron of EA-6Bs. I was just curious, you mentioned that you worked on them and that the transmitters were very high power. I'm fully aware of that. My question is, just how much protection did that canopy afford the crew? This is N2AIR.
Yeah, the canopy did have a gold plating to the surface, which was reasonably optically transparent, but a pretty good shield for the pilot, co-pilot. There's four people inside of the canopy of an EA-6B. They are very, very well protected, in my opinion, for about three reasons. Number one, the jamming pod is on a pylon mounted below the wing. The pilot and his cockpit are above the wing. So the wing is in between him and that jammer, and that wing does give you a lot of shielding. On top of that, the actual transmitter itself has a fairly highly directed antenna that's directed at the horizon. So the amount of side lobes and leakage signal coming out of the side of that antenna is quite small. I was the principal investigator, which took an EA-6B full-size airplane with a jamming pod on it, mounted it at the pedestal at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, and measured the antenna pattern of those jamming pods. And I've seen those graphs. The amount of signal on that antenna pattern that gets toward the pilot is quite small. On top of that, the cockpit has this gold plating, and there's also the metal shielding. It's only above a certain level of the fuselage, where the metal of the fuselage turns into glass, which is the cockpit, turns into plastic, polycarbonate, I think it is. And so, it is my opinion. Now, I haven't seen an exact measurement of this. Let me drop it. It is my opinion, from what I know about distance, shielding, wings in between, and the gold plating of the canopy. If I dig deep enough, I probably can find a report that's going to tell you that what the pilot, co-pilot, and the offensive officer and defensive officer, what the four people on board, what were they being exposed to, it probably is around 1% of the permitted maximum exposure. It's probably in the vicinity of 1%, 20 dB down. But I'm reasonably sure that a number of tests were done, which is not, that's not the exact test that we were doing. But I guarantee a number of tests were done, particularly at Patuxent River Naval Air Station, as to how much those pilots were exposed to. That that aircraft has existed in roughly 1986, 87, 88. Well, wait a minute, I said 1966. 1966, 67, 68 is when that aircraft was being created by Grumman Aircraft. And so we've got a lot of years of service. So there's a lot of history between that, around that particular aircraft. It's kind of amazing that an aircraft is that old is still being considered that useful this many years downrange, Greg. N2AIR. And if you find out more, I'd like to know about it. K2IIW in the TechNet. You got it, Greg.
Hey, thanks very much, Dick. the prowlers are no more. The Navy, at least the Navy, I'm not sure about the Marines, but the Navy has switched over to F-18s. I think they call them EA-18s, EA-18Gs, and they're called growlers instead of prowlers. But the prowlers are gone. I'm sorry sorry to hear that, because it was a very dependable airplane, but they were running out of parts. They were bastardizing parts out of the A6 intruders out in the desert, but prowlers are gone. That's why my son got out of it, and he's finishing up his career in recruiting. Back to you. This is N2AIR.
Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear that, and I think that's short-sighted. And I think there's a 50-50 chance that that opinion of abandoning that aircraft is likely to be reversed if another major incident occurs. Engines that are on that EA-6 airplane are really potent. Now, that airplane, as the Navy says it, that thing has legs. In other words, it can take off from a carrier, it's got a whole lot of power, and it can loiter for a significant amount of time during the racetrack pattern, standing way off, doing standoff jamming, and making it very difficult for somebody to use their offensive radar against us, if you know what I mean. The F-18 airplane, it's a nice, fast airplane, but it doesn't have anywhere near the amount of legs, doesn't have anywhere near the amount of duration, doesn't have anywhere near the engine power. An EA-6B could take as many as five of those jamming pods, one on each, two of them on each wing and one on the fuselage, a total of five, and still fly very well with them, and still for very long periods of time. I'd be amazed if they could put more than one or two on an F-18. And even when they do that, I'll bet you the duration of which it can fly and do its job is probably one quarter of the amount of time of what an EA-6 can do. So if we have another major incident, I think that so-called mothballed airplane is going to be brought back out of mothballs, is my opinion, Greg. N2AIR, K2IIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Dick. As far as I know, that was one of the only true jet aircraft that was left in the carrier fleet. But it was so ugly, that plane, that it was beautiful. And I've got some really great pictures because I was lucky enough to go on a Tiger cruise on one of my son's med cruises. And I got real close upfront photographs of them taking off and landing. And they are extremely loud. As a matter of fact, when I was on the carrier, one of the guys working on deck, one of the greenies, had one of his cavities loose, his fillings loosened up just from the blast as the EA-6B took off. That's about all I have to add. Thank you very much. This is N2AIR, 73 and all that jazz.
Question. Yeah, before I pass it over to Eric for his question, because I was there during some of when it happened, Grumman Aircraft put out a request for bid, a request for quote, as to how a high sensitivity, high directivity direction finding system can be put on that airplane so that the airplane can find out which direction is the radar signal coming from, so it knows which direction to do its jamming back into. And so this clearly defined request for a quote came out in roughly 1966, I think it was, and they were told in no uncertain terms, do not use the vertical stabilizer. It isn't strong enough. There was a genius of an aerodynamicist, a guy who is an experimental aircraft associate member, a guy named Slim Hoshberger, who worked at AIL. Very tall, very interesting character, Slim Hoshberger. And so he forced them to write a proposal, Grumman, to write a proposal to Grumman from AIL saying that if you beef up the fuselage in this manner, if you add this gusset and this stringer to the vertical stabilizer, then you can create a football on the top of the vertical stabilizer that will do very interesting six-sector direction finding. So they were told in no uncertain terms to use the vertical stabilizer, and he taught them how to do it, and that's how the airplane became that particular design, how A6 became EA6, but that football on the vertical stabilizer that gives you very good direction finding. After that, you now know which direction to set the directional antenna on each one of those jamming pods in order to send the signal back in the right direction. I wonder if your son had ever heard any of that particular story. You could say that that wasn't supposed to happen, Greg. Over to you, Greg, and then I'll go over to Eric. N2 AIR, K2AIO. And by the way, N2 AIR, air.
Repeater, timeout.
That kind of call that is, Greg, that is overly coincidental. Your son works in naval air, and your N2 AIR, obviously that stands for Naval 2 AIR, Naval 2 Air. Naval 2 Air. That is no coincidence to have that set of call letters. That is a vanity call, very carefully selected, isn't it, Greg? N2 AIR, K2RIW.
That's really funny, Dick. That is the first time I have actually thought about that. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. I got the call because it was easy to remember. My old call was KA2UAY, and I had just recently got back into CW, and N2AIR was, like I said, not only a nice, easy to remember call, it's much more CW friendly. That's why I had chosen that one. But now it's taking on a whole other meaning. Thanks a lot, Dick. This is N2AIR.
And for any of you guys who go to QIZ.com and you look up N2AIR, you'll see this beautiful picture of a guy who's, I think he's holding a very large fluke. You're obviously quite a fisherman. Looks like you also were heavily involved in guitars. Okay. Doesn't tell me the year of birth. Some people get that removed. But lots of good information. And it's a nice picture. Go ahead, Eric. KQ2EJ. KQRIW.
Did you by any chance check your email at AWRL.net?
I checked my email 2 hours ago. 2 days ago, I received from you the complete manual on that broadcast transmitter. And I looked at portions of it. I looked at the schematic diagram. I looked at your photographs of the actual tube itself and the way it had been beat up. And think about the filament of that tube. 5 volts at 90 amperes, 450 watts goes into that filament. Now, did that filament get wiped out by the lightning stroke? Could a lightning strike wipe out that filament? That is an unusual failure. So maybe that's what you're referring to, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW,
got
it. Actually, we were hoping that you would have dropped by the landmark short tube and capped with it. Or anything like that. Also, I remember in, I think it was Thursday, our global medical on harnessing had a voice making nanoscale antennas. By the way, it's up and working. It's a very happy campus. Had a little minor problem. It turns out to be a naval energy. It's your IWC system.
Yeah, Eric has had the interesting position of traveling to this broadcast station, FM broadcast station. I think it's Secaucus, New Jersey, is where you were going. The tube itself is in the final of that transmitter. It's a 4CX3500, as I remember. In other words, the tube has 3,500 watts of plate dissipation capability, forced air-cooled ceramic tube with them. Looks like you're going to have to do some adjusting there, Eric. the tube takes 5 volts at 90 amperes. Okay, yep. You probably can figure out where that signal is coming from, Eric. And how in the world did that filament get blown? Another screen bypass capacitor was also arced over. And you also found that the fan wasn't turning correctly, supplying air to the tube. And so lots of things had to be corrected. And I think you're telling me now the tube is putting out full... I think you're telling me the tube is now putting out full power output, and it's happy. That roughly true, Eric? And by the way, I think that was their standby transmitter, and they have another transmitter they were using in the meantime. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ.
No, that's the main transmitter. I'm waiting for them to, for the CFO to get off at Tushy. I actually found a really nice replacement for it. So the other transmitter that's there is a 1952 Hayden transmitter that was at 400 and 146 in the driver. But yeah, no, that transmitter, the BG is up and running. Very happy. Although the original diagnosis was very misleading, because it turned out, in the box of all that, look at the control circuitry, they do a sense of the positive screen supply and the screen supply return. The shunt resistor that used the meter and all circuitry was open. So the way I found it was I actually disconnected the screen voltage and pulled the tube out of the socket, fired the thing up. I almost thought I had a bad tube socket at first, but then I disconnected the screen voltage from the carriage to the tube system. I still having the problem, so that turned out to be sensitive to the power supply. That was very misleading, but I also had the screen bypass cap that was breaking down once you hit about 250 volts. That was fun, too. RWK, good day.
Make a guess, Eric. How much of that error, of all those errors you just described, how much of that could have been created by the lightning bolt that hit that particular broadcast station? How much of it could have been insufficient periodic maintenance? What's your guess as to how all that came about, Eric? And maybe you don't know, and maybe it would take too much speculation. But had enough periodic maintenance taken place, certainly the fan that wasn't turning on the driver circuit, I think that would have been discovered quite a long time ago. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
How to make it drop. No, don't get confused. The fan and the IPA was about 4 months ago, so that wasn't part of this study. The reason why I figure it's lightning is because I lost about 6 CMOS chips in the control board, and it appears that, you know, if you want to do a high enough voltage. By the way, a lightning strike doesn't have to be a direct lightning hit. For example, here at channel 21, I've had close cloud-to-cloud strikes to actually take out the FCC op-amp without thinking about it. Because I had an intercom system that basically set input op-amps on the bars that were basically twisted pair and unshielded. So, you know, if there's voltage, causes it to go bye-bye. And then we've also had, when lightning hits the tower, I've had to take out a whole bunch of Ethernet stuff. Things like that. Ever since I changed the shielding to the cable, that did it all. So I'm pretty confident that, you know, plus maybe a direct strike, but an air strike of lightning that had an effect. And maybe there was a cascading effect, although the chip that broke down, if you look at the circuitry, things that actually relate to the tube and the different box and all of that stuff was attacked. If you look, you'll see there's a thing called a power control. And if it did actually come down the line and line voltage, you know, spike in line voltage, it would have affected a lot of other gear that's been affected. So that's just my guess. But I've never seen the filament open like that, so. Let's stop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I was hearing you very well on the input. You did time out for the last 10 seconds or so, Eric. Most of the lightning bolts come from the cloud to ground lightning comes from a cloud where the bottom of the cloud is negatively charged, and a negative lightning bolt, I think the average one is around 11,000 amperes for that operation. 11,000 amperes for something like 20 microseconds. The roughly 10% of the time, Mother Nature does the opposite and makes a positive lightning cloud, positive bottom. And those are the ones which are about 10 times louder. So instead of 11,000 amperes, you get 100,000 amperes. And so some of these lightning bolts are extremely loud and extremely potent. Quite often those are the positive ones, the rare ones. And boy, can they do damage. And even if it strikes the ground 500 yards from you, it makes an extremely strong local magnetic field, EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And that EMP is such that every conducting piece of wire in the neighborhood picks up some number of kilovolts per meter of length of wire. And as such, antennas can pick up some fierce voltage. Your LIPA and Con Ed power wiring can pick up some fierce voltages. There was one of those kind of a lightning bolt, about 8 or so years ago that occurred in my neighborhood. Let me drop it. It wasn't a direct strike. As I said, it struck the power lines, probably a good number of blocks away from my house. It struck power lines. And so me and my neighbors had an awful lot of damage of computers and air conditioners, refrigerators, and television sets. My television set was heavily damaged. Much of the equipment, computing equipment in my house was heavily damaged. None of the ham radio equipment experienced any damage, which was really amazing. And it took me quite a while to repair all of that. And my neighbors were all making similar complaints. And I could tell from the way my insurance company was responding that quite a few of my neighbors were also hollering about their equipment that became failed in that particular event for quite a number of blocks in all directions. So some of these super lightning bolts, which are positively charged, and there's ways that we can build fairly simple instrumentation by which you can find out, is that lightning cloud passing over your, is that potentially lightning-created cloud passing over your house, is that a positive or negatively charged one? Doesn't take very expensive, $2 worth of electronics that you can homebrew if you go to the right website can allow you to measure the polarity of the local E field, if you know what I mean. NASA, let me drop it.
Cannot be ready.
NASA uses similar equipment to find out, is there a local cloud coming by with potential lightning capability, which are, they need that kind of warning before you're going to do a launch of a space vehicle. You don't want to launch into a lightning cloud because the damage can be pretty severe. I'm not sure which one of the Apollo missions, I think it was Apollo 12 or Apollo 14, one of those that the astronauts have been thoroughly trained for that particular episode. And so during the launch, after they had left the launch pad, the lightning bolt literally struck the craft, and it tripped a number of their circuit breakers. And so during the mission, during the early stages of the mission, the astronauts were resetting circuit breakers to continue the rest of the rocket blast, to continue the rest of the mission. Quite an exciting event. After that, NASA became a lot more conservative about whether or not they will launch when there are local clouds. Back to you, any further information on all of the above, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
WK2J. Okay, I think I pretty much covered it. There's been a lot of instances where my tower here gets whacked fairly often in the summer. And I've got a pretty much stable where just things don't happen. As with games experience, the engine, of course, actually seem to work, so. Actually, recently worked. It's pretty neat design, but haven't had a problem since. So don't forget it, the World Trade Center, that thing is just hit 5, 6, sometimes 10 times a night. So nobody really seems to have been bothered by that. Plus the fact that the antennas are going into a component, a lot of stuff in between the tents, the wide place. Back to you, Dick. K2IW,
K2J.
I think you were actually in the in the room where the transmitter itself is located of your broadcast center in Plainview. And I think on one or two occasions the lightning bolt did strike the tower, either very nearby or directly. And I think while you were there you heard a very loud noise. Lightning was jumping from some object to some other object in the broadcast center itself. So give us a couple of words on what that was like, Eric. Were you also ever at the World Trade Center during a lightning storm? Were you in the room with the transmitter? Did you ever hear some funny sounds, if you know what I mean? Give us a few words on what you have experienced at your broadcast centers, both in New York City and in Plainview, during a lightning storm, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, I've been in both places when lightning actually hit the tower, and you actually feel with pressure, the compression that comes about. See this huge white flash that's coming in through all the windows. It's really quite loud. I mean, it literally rings for like 2 or 3 minutes afterwards. And at World Trade, when, don't forget that the tower, on top of the tower is at 6 and 300 feet. You've got a lot of insulation between the outside and you. Don't really notice the lightning so much at World Trade when it hit it. But no, it didn't announce itself like it does. It didn't stay here in Plainview. Interesting thing about World Trade is you've got a good night like that. When I used to live in Astoria, we put the camera on the roof and opened the shutter and just had this really gorgeous picture of multiple lightning strikes hitting your antenna. Sorry, WK, here we go.
The lightning strike itself, 11,000 or 100,000 amperes, is an extremely intense plasma. The thunder it makes because the locally heated air is expanding at a supersonic rate, literally. So it makes one hell of an acoustic shockwave. And at one time, the building that you had in Plainview, I seem to remember it had the equivalent of sheet metal walls. And so when you get this huge acoustic overpressure of what the lightning bolt is creating outside the walls on that tower that is a couple of hundred feet above you, I can see how those sheet metal walls will move, and therefore that shockwave inside the building is very easily acoustically communicated to you and sets your ears ringing. Whereas at World Trade Center, you've got much more steady construction, so to speak, and there's such an awful lot of that can no longer communicate through those walls and get into where you were residing. Bunch of guesses on my part. I wonder if any of that has even close to Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Pretty much got it right, Dick. I mean, the door to the roof at the World Trade Center is so thick and so heavy. You get the door open, actually, when you're going out the roof. You open up the air pressure, it's working against you. It's quite an experience. But the interesting thing about World Trade is that we have little hatches in the roof, so lights go out and people come in. So it's there, but you don't get the shockwave. You don't get the compression feeling. If lightning hits Plainview, you wonder if the building's going to collapse on you when that happens.
Another question I've got, Eric, is that on the windiest, stormiest night at World Trade, when Mother Nature is really whipping, did you ever feel the building moving? Everyone thinks that building sways a little bit. Depending on who you talk to, they come up with the swaying of inches versus feet. And there are people who claim that they would be in a men's room on one of the upper floors, and they would watch the water in the toilet flashing back and forth, or was it splashing up and down because the air pressure changes? That ain't clear. So on the windiest, stormiest night that you've ever been at World Trade, did you sense the building moved a little bit? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Sorry, WK2EJ, I think I called it the toilet bowl. They say the building moves a maximum of 8 inches in my own hour wind. I've been there on 3 minutes, which I have a glass sitting on the table. Perfectly still, and all of a sudden, it'll start to wiggle. Bathroom, and you'll see the water that was still a moment ago is sort of like, not sloshing, but it's sort of just wiggling a little bit back and forth in the toilet bowl. You know that the building's moving, maybe ever so slightly, but it's moving.
There was an article that I remember reading a few years ago. I'm not sure how well founded the article was, how authoritative, which claimed that there used to be a facility in New York City which were giving people haircuts for free, and the excuse they were given is that these were haircut trainees, and so the people that were being trained, while they're being trained, were giving free haircuts. In reality, you were being brought into a room, put into a barber chair, and somebody was cutting your hair, and the whole room was on rollers, and they were moving the room, trying to find out that without warning, how much motion could be tolerated before you would suddenly say, hey, I don't feel right, something funny going on here. So by way of these really objective measurements, we found out how much motion people would tolerate, and supposedly dampers were put into the building and braces were put into the building of World Trade so that on a windy day you didn't exceed that amount of motion that would make people uncomfortable. I wonder if you've heard any of the stories like that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. No, I've actually not heard anything like that. Then again, my experience there is only for a country like this. More than the deadline, down and done. So I probably don't know anybody that would have stories like that. Well, the building engineers, there was a lot of old guys too. Fuck that one.
KC2MMY comment.
KC2MMY. Go right ahead. K2LIW.
I remember when I was in the World Trade Center there when the plane was on 49 or 52. I could swear, but not back. So, you know, maybe it was an illusion, but I don't think so. I at least 6 inches.
Ray, you're far from the only person saying that. Once again, what floor were you on? Was it building number one? I think it was building number one. I think you said you were on floor number 50. And I believe the aircraft hit at somewhere around floor 75. Is that roughly true, Ray? So you felt the building move a whole lot. My guess is you probably heard chunks of tiles out of the ceiling coming down and other things creaking and crunching. So there were various people saying they felt the building move, they felt it snap back, and even though announcements were being made over the PA system to stay on station, to stay in your office, I'm awful glad to hear that you apparently are one of the smarter people who decide that, hey, this doesn't sound right, I'm leaving. Give us some stories as to what it was like, Ray. KC2MMY, K2LIW.
I was in Tower 1, which got hit first, but fell last. So, I mean, when I got out, was at least a half hour to stay on this minute. So I didn't see mine fall. I saw the other one fall. But, when I was up there, it was like a big explosion I heard above my head. It felt like it was right on the next floor above me, but I guess it was 20 floors up. So it was like the 80th floor. And I'm telling you, that Tilton moved a foot in one direction and snapped back. And that's what was so scary. When we were standing there, I was looking at another guy, and me and him looked at each other, and then we started running. But when we were standing there on, I think it was the 49th floor, I mean, everything moved. We moved a foot and snapped back, and you knew something serious was wrong, and then we started running. So there was quite a bit of movement. I suppose it doesn't move that much on a windy day. I guess you have to have a jet to have it move that far. But it felt like at least a foot. I mean, it was a definitive, everything moved.
Now, that particular airplane, I don't know the exact number. A fully loaded 747 can be as high as 750,000 pounds. Now, this was a slightly smaller airplane, but it was fully loaded with fuel. I'll bet you that airplane was in the vicinity of 150,000 to 200,000 pounds. Struck the building probably in the vicinity of 400 or 500 miles an hour. So the amount of impulse projected onto that building by 200,000 pounds of mass moving at 500 miles an hour, striking the building and being decelerated, probably penetrating the building, I'm going to pick a number, 100 feet. So it's being decelerated within 100 feet from that velocity and that much mass. There are various ways by which you could do a rough approximation back to the envelope calculation as to how much compliance that steel building would have, if we could make a rough guess as to what was its oscillating frequency and how far it would move. And you felt it moved a foot? Boy, I believe it. And my guess is you and your buddy felt that snap back.